Half a league onward, all in the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death, rode the 600.
150 years after the Crimean War, Russian tour guide Olga Makarova recites Alfred Lord Tennyson's famous poem to a group of Crimean War enthusiasts in the actual Valley of Death into which the 600 members of the Light Brigade charged. But it wasn't the Russian guns that did for most of the 20,000 who died in that terrible war. It was the accounting methods used by the British government, says Warwick Fennell of Kent University.
Indeed, it was estimated that 90% of all deaths in the Crimean War were caused by neglect, by starvation, by exposure, because there were not sufficient supplies there to ensure the army was able to fight in an effective manner and able to also survive in what was a very alien environment at that time. Their finances, their supplies, were all controlled by the Treasury.
At the start of the 19th century, professional standing armies were thought to be both politically dangerous and inherently inefficient, a view of the military that went back to the English Civil War.
The relationship between the army and Parliament, certainly since the 17th century, has always been a relationship of suspicion and many times of fear as well. Parliament has always been aware that the military represents a possible threat to liberty, and this has been demonstrated in the 17th century, both at the time of the Revolution and then subsequently the dictatorship under Cromwell, and in the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when James II surreptitiously, that is without the knowledge of Parliament, had taken money designed for other purposes and had used that money to build up an army which was potentially going to be used to threaten the existence of Parliament. That relationship in the 17th century and Parliament's reaction to that established the nature of the controls, the posture that the Parliament and also the nation had towards the army for well over 200 years, certainly well into the 20th century.
Part of the deal was that the finances of the armed forces would now come under parliamentary control. Strict accounting procedures had to be followed. It probably stopped the army becoming too powerful. But it also meant that by the time of the Crimean War, the military was unable to benefit from any of the cost accounting innovations that were allowing manufacturing industry to operate efficiently back home. The result was an inflexible and ultimately disastrous civilian bureaucracy, even on the battlefield.
The Treasury had its presence in the Crimea through a group called the Commissariat. And the Commissariat was employed by the Treasury, they were answerable to the Treasury, and yet they were there to supply the military with all the needs it required to fight a war successfully. But their responsibilities, their accountability was to the Treasury, not to the military, and that created huge problems. The members of the Commissariat, the officers there, knew that they would have to provide precise, detailed accounting records of their performance, of their duties in the Crimea. So what mattered to them most was not ensuring that the army was well provisioned, not ensuring that the men were fed, were properly clothed, had tents. What was most important for them was ensuring that when they had to give an explanation of what had happened to all the goods that they had been provided by the Treasury, they were able to do that in a detailed fashion, following detailed regulations. What this meant, for example, was the soldiers were entitled to one great coat every 3 years. Now, that was fine when you were living in barracks, say, in Britain. But when you were living in the exposed circumstances of the Crimea, the great coat would only last a few months, if that. So men would go to the commissariat store and they would say, please, I need a coat. And it was in the middle of winter time and they were freezing to death. I need a coat. And the commissariat told them, despite what they saw before their eyes, said, you are not entitled to a coat for another 2 years or whatever, you will not get a coat, even though they had thousands of coats in the store behind them.
Even Florence Nightingale complained that
the commissariat officers fixed their attention on their bookkeeping as the primary object of life.
The Crimean War was widely recognised at the time as a logistical as well as a strategic disaster. But despite the public outcry, many of the problems were repeated nearly 50 years later in the Boer War. accounting was still seen as a constitutional protection rather than a management tool that could ensure that wars were fought efficiently. It wasn't until 1906 that a Secretary of State for War, Richard Haldane, tried to incorporate some of the values of business into the military.
Richard Haldane was determined that the military would be given the opportunity for the first time for centuries to be masters of their own financial destiny. He said the military in the modern world had to adopt some of the methods of business. War had become a business. War had become scientific. War had become something which had to be taken very seriously, not left to amateurs. So Haldane realised it was important to have people who were trained in this. And to commence that, he introduced this new course for army officers at the London School of Economics. And this course persisted on and off until 1932. It is suggested by many that this was one of the reasons why the British were so well prepared in some ways for World War I.
But not all accounting historians believe that accounting techniques were simply used to make the military more efficient. According to Michel Chastiak from the University of New Mexico, during the time of the Vietnam War, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara used accounting to shift the balance of power in military affairs away from the generals towards the civilians in the Department of Defense. To do it, he came up with a technique called Planning, Programming and Budgeting, PPB.
Prior to planning, programming, and budgeting, the military basically argued for weapon systems and things of that nature based on military need. And they, of course, the generals, etc., are experts on what military need is. And Robert McNamara couldn't argue with them on those lines, so he made the military express their needs in terms of economic efficiency, which was something he was an expert in.
Under McNamara, war was more like a proper business with measurable inputs, for example, money spent on weapons, and outputs, such as number of enemy deaths. The language of cost-benefit analysis came to dominate military decision-making.
Progress in the Vietnam War was measured through statistics. The belief was, unfortunately, that if we could kill the Viet Cong faster than they could reproduce themselves, we could win. So the body count, that statistic became the primary method of measuring progress in the Vietnam War. Unfortunately, many of the statistics were inflated. Actually, the statistics were meaningless because the Vietnamese wanted to gain control of their country and weren't going to be discouraged by the U.S. actions. But because this budgeting system drove all defense decisions, there was this mindset that those same criteria could be used to control war.
Once again, accounting makes certain things visible, but by doing so, it makes other things less visible. And according to Michel Chastiak, PPB was failing to measure the things that actually mattered.
The soldiers eventually began to realize that they were just cannon fodder, should we say. And there were combat refusals. Another thing that happened was what they called fraggings, and that was when the soldiers decided to threaten to kill their commanding officers. So I would say the mismatch between the government's management of this war and the soldiers' reality was actually one of the large contributors to the U.S. needing to withdraw, that basically the army was falling apart.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Michel Chastiak argues that accounting techniques have been used by the military-industrial complex to expand its area of influence. But the US Department of Defense showed itself remarkably inept in financial matters when it set up a body to administer Iraq after the defeat of Saddam. Christine Cooper from Strathclyde University, Department of Accounting.
The authority that ran Iraq after the war from April 2003 until June 2004 was the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, led by the US. And about 50% of the funds that they had were actually legitimately Iraqi money. There was a lot of oil money, and there were a few other things like bank accounts that had been frozen around the world, and riches and goods and things that soldiers had seized from Saddam's palaces and things like that. So the Americans were going to spend a lot of money on behalf of the Iraqi people. And because of that, the United Nations said that their accounts needed to be audited.
The CPA was required by its own rules to appoint an independent auditing firm. But the firm that got the job was not a certified public accountant, but rather a consulting firm. When proper auditors, KPMG, were finally appointed, they discovered a financial shambles.
What the accountants actually found was that the Coalition Provisional Authority weren't good administrators, didn't actually keep proper double-entry accounts. I mean, you could argue, OK, this was a very difficult situation because there'd been a war and they'd moved in, and this was a country, you know, that lots of its infrastructure had actually been destroyed. But it seemed that their priority wasn't to bring in good governance. For example, a lot of the revenue came from oil money, and yet the oil wasn't metered in any way whatsoever. So it's very, very difficult to actually know exactly how much oil was stolen and how much oil was actually sold properly and used for the benefit of the Iraqi people. And when the auditors arrived, they were actually quite shocked that very, very basic control mechanisms weren't in place. And this was kind of reflected in the fact that the administrators in the CPA just used a kind of a single entry system of accounting.
For 500 years, accountants have known that one of the advantages of double entry is that it makes it harder to perpetrate fraud. But as far as the Coalition Provisional Authority was concerned, double entry bookkeeping might never have been invented.
This was an authority that was in charge of, you know, billions of dollars, not of US money, but of Iraqi money. And all of the kind of normal financial controls went totally out of the window, and accounts were kept in a really old-fashioned, very basic format, basically just kind of almost like lists. So there was disregard for proper administration. And yet that was the time when it was absolutely most important to try to encourage transparency, encourage good accountability, fair kind of business practice. Accounting is just a reflection of what was going on. Definitely accounting can't capture the social implications or the human implications of the activities of the military. But that doesn't mean to say then that after the war, it could have actually been quite useful.
Surely an understatement. Up to $20 billion of Iraq's oil revenue was never properly accounted for. And arguably, this lack of transparency reduced the legitimacy of the CPA in the minds of ordinary Iraqis. Whatever your opinion of accountants, what happened in Iraq is a warning of what happens if you try to manage without them.